Group meeting, Sunday, 15th November 1981. We have taken up the meetings since September with the subject of meditation. In September, we considered, as best as we could, the deep and true meaning of meditation and the meditative state. And it is rather important to emphasize this because everybody who rushes to a meditation teacher or wants to do meditation thinks of it in terms of a process of thinking. Just musing on some particular topic. Maybe, of course, also paying concentrated attention to a chosen subject of meditation. But if you examine the process very carefully, you will see that all that is happening is that you are talking silently about that subject. And this talk is the result of all that we have already experienced in our lives through the use of our five senses. It belongs to the realm of the worldly, to the realm of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. It is the realm of the known. Now, that is a necessary step in the beginning, undoubtedly, because we have to start from where we are. We can't suddenly produce a PhD thesis if we are still in the kindergarten or the junior school. That is obvious to everybody. But we also have this much knowledge about the subject of meditation, that meditation actually is the movement, the activity of our innermost consciousness at its own transcendent level. And this activity of consciousness at its own transcendent level is completely beyond all thought processes. Absolutely beyond it all. Thought doesn't enter into it. For the very simple reason that the transcendent, as we have seen again and again, the context of the transcendent is the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. And there are no positive descriptive words for it, for the very simple reason that the transcendent context is a nondescript context. It is realizable by human beings, but the nature of that realization has no relationship to all that we realize in our limited finite world through the use of our five senses and our ordinary inward thinking process, as we call it. The sort of process that a mathematician or a philosopher goes through, musing about things, getting bright ideas and so forth. It has nothing to do with that. It is a movement, an activity of consciousness in its own innermost depth and in its sublimest height, which can never be expressed, because all expression is a limitation. Now that should be quite clear, shouldn't it? All expression is a limitation. And the infinite cannot be limited. When we attempt to talk about the infinite as such, we limit it with our words and our concepts. But you can experience it, you can realize it, if there are certain preconditions present. So we considered that in September, and last month we considered certain points with regard to the psyche. What is the state of the psyche which is a necessary precondition for one's consciousness to enter that transcendent depth? The psyche is completely purified. It is utterly free of all defilements whatsoever. If it is free, then the light of transcendence can shine through it. Otherwise, the impure psyche presents positive obstructions always to the light of transcendence. That is one necessary precondition for true meditation in its real sense. And there is also another condition. And that is that the entire psychophysical organism is in a completely still state. There is no psychophysical disturbance, turmoil going on, which would create an obstruction to the entry into that transcendent condition by one's profoundest consciousness. Now, when I say these things, it is difficult not to avoid the idea that when profoundest consciousness enters the transcendent state, it will know that transcendent state. No, that is not the case at all. Because the word know and knowing, at any level of consciousness that we ordinarily are capable of realizing, involves a particular thought form, a particular shape, a concept, an idea, and so forth. And that is a limitation. So it doesn't involve any sort of knowing. What happens is that one's own innermost consciousness now is transcendent. Consider why, not only in India, in terms of Hinduism and Buddhism, but in the West too, Eckhart said outright, "Man verily is God, and God verily is man." And God is the indefinable. In Christian theology, God is manifested in the finite world through Jesus Christ. That Christ consciousness is the divine consciousness at work in the man Jesus. The man Jesus, being the sinless one, the utterly pure one, is the holy grail, the fit vessel through whom that transcendence can manifest itself. You see, this is what happens. So we have it in all the great religions of the world. I don't know whether Islam as such has any such presentation. I don't think that the Quran presents anything like that. But in Sufism you do have it. And in the case of that great Islamic Sufi, Al-Halaj, he openly said, "An al-haq." He said to the people, "If you do not believe in me, at least believe in the signs which God has sent unto you. I am that sign." Well, that was the same thing as saying, "I am God." And for that they crucified him in the most cruel way. So you see, all the great religions of the world, or at least in their mystical aspects, you have this teaching of the nature of that realization. So now that is the meditative state, the state in which you, as a separate you, are completely out. You are reinstated as integral part and parcel, and as an unidentifiable separate entity within the totality. this is what particularly the Western world fights against very, very strongly. They will not have the destruction of personality. I am forever and ever, and so forth. And yet, in Christian mysticism, you find it quite openly taught. So now, if that is the meditative state, the true meditative state, one who desires, rather than desire, shall I say, one who aspires to enter into true meditation, will ask, well then, what do I do about it? Well, the answer is very simple, and the difficulty of carrying it out is proportional. Proportional to its simplicity. It is almost impossibly difficult within our lifetime, and yet it can be done if, and the main if is the complete purification of the person, the personality, the psychophysical organism, you, the existential being. If you completely cleanse yourself, become completely cleansed, then that state of consciousness will function through you. It is not a case of you will be conscious that way, etc., etc. Is this too confusing or muddling, or is it fairly clear? The transcendent functions through you, takes complete possession of you, and manifests itself at the level of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. This is the miracle, the wonder of it all. This is why those perfected holy ones who realized that state were called the sons of God, the children of God, the Brahmaputras, as they said in India. You see, this is the reason. Or they put it in an impersonal form, as the Buddha did. He openly declared and confirmed those of his disciples who declared it of him, that he was the Dhamma become, the Dhamma Bhuta. Bhuta means become. The Brahma become. He uses the word Brahman, the Upanishadic term for the Supreme, the Absolute. So now you see the implications of that. That sort of being, the perfected Holy One, in the case of Jesus, he said, I and my Father are one. Are one, not I am in the Father merely. I and my Father are one, you see. Now, when that takes place, there is the full meditative condition, the transcendent condition. It is something which is the supreme realization possible to human beings like us. We are an animal species. We are derived from an animal ancestor. And we bear all the obstructiveness of the limited animal nature in us, which prevents transcendence from functioning straight away in us from the time we are born onwards. You see? It is our task to realize this purification by which the transcendent can manifest itself. Then, that first verse, that first chapter of Genesis, verses 25 and 26, suddenly light up with full meaning, a light which fills the universe, so to say. And Elohim said, as the translation goes, I prefer the word minded, and Elohim minded, let us create man, not make man. Making is a limited material something. Let us create man in our own living likeness, not in our image. I don't like the translation image at all, although the Hebrew word may really mean image. I don't know Hebrew, so I can't say. But let us create man in our own living likeness. And what was the, one can, at our level, we can conjecture a possible reason why. In order that the embodied transcendence can be a representation and an inspiration in the world of imperfect people to strive towards their ultimate realization. And by that means, bring peace and harmony throughout the entire throughout the entire human species. This is something absolutely tremendous. People frequently ask, what is the purpose of our existence? Well, this is one form in which we can express the purpose of human existence. There are other forms too. I'll just suggest one. In the evolutionary process, from the beginning of the primordial creative energy at work, in the evolutionary process, there came into being several grades and grades of manifestation. And these grades of manifestation are non-physical to start with. They are represented by the names of the angels and the archangels and so forth, as also by the names of the demons and the asuras and the destructive agencies in the universe. They are all represented that way, but we have forgotten their meanings. We have forgotten the significance of those names. Now, they function, the archangels and so on, we mustn't picture them in human terms. This is where we have all gone wrong. They represent forms, archetypal forms, through which that primordial creative energy functions throughout the total universe, not merely the cosmos that we can examine as astronomers and physicists and so forth. It's the total cosmos, you see. All right. So now, those energies can play through us, individual human beings, insofar as we make ourselves fit instruments for the reception of those energies. And when those energies can find the right sort of person, well, then that energy makes itself known. Take one example of it. Genius. Particularly genius in, say, art, rather than philosophy. Because philosophy, by entering into the tremendous whirlpool of words, gets too limited and can be very misleading. All the greatest works of art, in music, poetry is a different matter, in music and in painting and so on, can be modes of manifestation of these archetypal creative energies at the cosmic level and on a universal scale. And that's how they come through to us in our life, through us. If we understand this, how extraordinary life becomes altogether. I mean, what are we human beings? What is man that thou hast made him only, what is it, slightly lesser than the angels or some such thing? What is the exact phrase?
Slightly lower than the angels.
Slightly lower than the angels. Lower, but not in the sense of not so good as. The potentiality within us is the total potentiality. The word which the religion has used, God or Brahman or anything, represents our supreme potentiality. Dormant in us, sleeping in us, enclosed within us, imprisoned within us. Now, are we going to live and work in such a manner that we allow that to manifest through us, or are we like the hundreds of thousands of millions of human beings who have been born on the globe and have died in the 4 million years or so that we have been on this planet, just wasted, no realization? And you see, our potentiality and our possibility is something tremendous. Now, of course, it would be easy for some critic, especially the half-baked psychologist, to say, oh, here is a case of, what is it, paranoia or all that sort of thing, you see, or megalomania or whatever it is. It isn't megalomania, paranoia. If you see, if you truly see a vision which shows me, and I'll just talk in personal terms, shows me, the person who has that vision, just exactly what my place is here. You know, the whole universe is composed of gas and dust particles and so forth. Science knows that very well nowadays. I, as a person, am less than one of those particles of countless particles of dust that float throughout the whole cosmos. I see my relationship. I am no thing, nothing. You see? When one really sees that, then there is no conflict of in one's own psyche of modesty on the one hand and conceit on the other. Self-conceit and modesty, there is no conflict at all. There is real humility. One knows just what one is, nothing. You see? But through that nothingness, that single invisible point, which is immeasurable, through that single point, transcendence itself, and the in terms both of the vastness of the universe and in terms of the infinity of the small, functions through that living point. That sort of person is truly the Son of God, a Brahmaputra. He's the Son of Man, and the word man means mind. What mind? Not mind as we imagine it with respect to ourselves, but mind as that archetypal form of the creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. So you see, our human responsibility is something absolutely tremendous, our responsibility. It is our duty in the supreme sense. Duty is all too often thought of as something which is imposed from outside upon us, something which we have to do. There is no compulsion whatsoever. That creative power compels no one. It waits with infinite patience. I'm talking in human language. It waits with infinite patience until the person himself, of his own sweet will and accord, will come unto the Lord, so to say. Now, when we see that, we will see at once what, we will only begin to see what religious living really means. And the meditative state is a state in which such things are realized, such visions are seen and known. Don't use the word, I have to use the word seen, because our languages cannot express that. You don't see, you don't know. You are that which you, as we say in our common language, see and know. You get it? You are that in innermost consciousness. The human organism as such, we call it a body, or we say it's a psychophysical organism. It is consciousness crystallized. consciousness being the person. And all, in our case, all our mental states, our feelings, our thoughts, our emotions, our words, our actions, are expressions, limited, halting expressions of that inner consciousness embodied here as the living person. You see how wonderful, how marvelous religion becomes when one begins to sort of have just a little glimpse of these things. But one mustn't get excited or enthused in the wrong way, because then we will always misdirect our energies. Our enthusiasms and excitements are always self-oriented, and they are in terms of the expression of the separate, self-conscious, self-oriented I am. This is what we have to beware of. This is the real devil, the one and only Mephistopheles. I am so and so. I am a personality, a film star or whatever it is, and I've got to present an image before the public and preserve that image or make that image more and more bloated. And all too often it is bloated. And there you are, you see. It's not that at all. Absolutely not. All right, so now to come back to this business of the of meditation at our levels in our condition. There are the great difficult, one of the greatest difficulties is just this. If we sit down to meditate as such, choose a subject for meditation or direct our thoughts, as we say, in a certain way. After a time, we might find other thoughts intruding themselves. Now, all the thoughts and feelings which intrude can be put into two groups, two categories. One is that of sense pleasures, of malevolence, of harming, of hurting, of cruelty and wrongdoing towards others. And often that wrongdoing is in the name of right doing, because we think that that person ought to be treated that way and so forth. That is one category. The other category is the reverse of that. The thoughts and feelings which are associated with renunciation, with relinquishment of all the harmful, the ill thoughts, of not harming, of not hurting, non-malevolence and so forth. Consider this matter very, very carefully. How do we think all the day long? What is our thought directed towards? We may say, oh yes, I am thinking about the work I've got to do. Of course, we all have to think about the work we've got to do. Good many people are so thoughtless that the work they do is rather a nuisance to everybody else. So we have to think about the work we do. But underlying that thinking, is there self-orientation? I must do it like this, I want to do it like that, in order to gain this, that and the other. We can look at it somewhat altruistically and say, in order to give a service to my fellow human beings, in order to serve my employer or my master or lord or king or teacher or whoever it is well, and so forth, you see. But look at it very, very carefully and see how subtly one's own ego, one's own vanity, one's self-esteem, and underlying it all, the fulfillment of some particular motive which characterizes my thinking is working. It's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. One discovers the selfness of what we commonly call the self. The psychophysical person, the existential being, is wholly self-enclosed. The supreme self is embodied in every existential being. But the existentiality of that being is the thing which encloses and imprisons the supreme self, the transcendent itself. See? And you will find, you will discover all this selfness present. Now, the forms in which that selfness expresses itself most strongly is in terms of sense pleasures. You ask any human being, how are you? Oh, I'm fine, I'm enjoying life. Yes, he is enjoying life, all the pleasures of the senses. This is not to suggest that one should discard all the pleasures of the senses. The discarding of the pleasures of the senses will come naturally as and when one fully understands the motivation behind the pleasure. There are certain pleasures which are inevitable, which are absolutely unavoidable. You step out on a out of your front door on a lovely moonlit night or a starlit night. There's an extraordinary, isn't it wonderful? Now, what are some of the characteristics of that experience? You didn't want the night to be lovely and starlit and all the rest of it. You didn't seek it. You stepped out, and there it was like that. And it just took you up into its immensity. And you were one with that terrific situation of totality. You were one with totality, if only for a fraction of a second. Now, that, and what's more, afterwards, you didn't want to grasp it and keep it. Oh, let's keep hold of this for the whole night and so forth. Well, some people do, maybe. But there is no possessiveness attached to that kind of pleasure. There is possessiveness attached when, on some other day, you recollect that experience and say, I would like to have it again. This is where the devil comes in. I would like to have it again. The repetition hardens the psyche, hardens your heart. You want to possess it and possess it. There are people who want to possess God all the time. There are many mystics who have been through all this, and they finally discovered that only by absolutely letting God plunge his spear into your very heart, it was only then that God really found them and they were one with God. And that has happened rarely, rather rarely. I think Ramakrishna in India was one such example. It's not a very good example because his outlook was neurotic, actually. That's what I say. But the society which he founded has done some excellent work in the world. They're a wonderful lot, those swamis of the Ramakrishna movement. They do very good service and so forth. Well, now, that is that sort of pleasure is unavoidable. It's, one need not consider whether it is legitimate or not. It's no good saying it is illegitimate because it happens. You can't help it. You get a lovely spring or late or early autumn sunshiny day in this country. And it's like magic. It's absolutely marvelous. But you breathe in that magic. You have become one with that magic. And you don't want to possess it. These are some of the non-possessiveness is one of the signs that it is a pure pleasure. And of course, it is scientifically known that the brain needs pleasurable experiences, because there are what are called the pleasure areas in the brain itself for the healthy working of the brain. So there must be pleasure that way too, you see. But if it is not self-oriented, not pursued, not planned, not desired, and not possessed afterwards, or wanting to be possessed, then that pleasure is pure. It's true happiness. And there it is. You see the smile on a little baby's face. I've seen it often and often, because when Sylvia takes me out into the park to take the dog out for the walk, daily walk, and I go around and I see the mothers trundling their little children along, and they suddenly look up at me and I smile, and the sort of divine smile that bursts out on their face in response. It's wonderful. Perfect happiness. They don't want to possess me or my smile. I don't want to possess them or their smile. And there it is. Free, perfect, divine. It's like that. So now, where sense pleasures are concerned, bear that in mind, that those pleasures are healthy pleasures. All the other pleasures are, in some degree or other, and in some way or other, harmful. They shut the doors on nirvana. And the same applies, the same sort of thing applies to our thoughts. When we get angry, when we feel hateful, when we feel like destroying something or somebody. You see, there are so many things that happen in the world which are so awful that we want to smash them up and destroy the people who are the perpetrators of such things. But all those thoughts and feelings which rise up in us are harmful to us. They are harmful to our environment. We charge the psychic atmosphere with evil all the time, with destructiveness, and we are doing nobody any good. Also, that kind of thinking prevents the mind, prevents the psyche from becoming purified. It induces a tendency, a slope towards evil. So one becomes more and more devilish as the years go by. Soured, bitter, harsh, cruel, destructive. So you see, we have to bear in mind these things. Now this is why the practice of mindfulness, the samasati, the perfect mindfulness, is so very important. When the practice of mindfulness culminates and reaches its peak point, then the organism is so mindful that no evil can find lodgment in it. No evil whatsoever. There is evil spread throughout the world. It fills the psychical atmosphere of the world. All over the world. But that influence will find no lodgment in you. The psyche will become purified by itself, therefore, if one is completely mindful. The mindfulness enables us to see clearly and truly just what we are. And if we have true self-knowledge and a true understanding of the way in which our own psyche functions, then we will know all other human beings also. You may ask, well, how will you know? A remarkable sensitivity which lies hidden in us comes out. It is this sensitivity by which one knows what is in the other person's psyche at any moment. That he's in a terrible mood, or he's this, that, or the other. One knows the other person when one meets one. You see, these are faculties which lie within us. They have been called clairvoyance and all that sort of thing. But never mind the clairvoyance, because when you say clairvoyance, people think in terms of, oh, seeing wonderful divine dances being performed by fairies and hobgoblins and goodness knows what. So forget all that. But this is the real clairvoyance, the clear seeing into oneself first and foremost, and realizing, and that clear seeing enables one to see the same in other people. Now, when one has purified oneself, one will never react in terms of hatred, anger, envy, jealousy, malevolence, or wanting to destroy or hurt anybody else for any reason whatsoever. Now, this is a very tremendous thing, really, isn't it? And when we think of what's going on around now in the country, the way that murder, thieving, lechery, and the whole host of evil things that are rampant throughout man's life today, it's very difficult to avoid feeling antagonism. And when the psyche is purified that way, then there is a natural relinquishment of all those elements in our nature which tend towards limitation, towards harm, sorrow, misery, and all the rest of it. You see. So the responsibility rests entirely with us. And when that happens, one begins to respond in terms of pure compassion. One has compassion for the evil doer, just as one has compassion for the one who has suffered, to whom evil has been done. Equally, one has to be equally compassionate to anybody and everybody, whoever he is. This is what affects the transformation of the devil into God. There's a real transformation. And this means that the organism, the psychophysical organism, is ready to enter the experience, the realization of pure meditation. And you will find things happen for which I have no words, and you will also, I think, agree when you experience such things that you will have no words for it. There will be peace, an inward peace, the sublime, unoriginated peace which the Buddha called Nirvana. And you will be a light unto the world in which you live.